ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last, and it's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud's going to take us down that road while he rides lightning, sharing with us professional wrestling history. His professional wrestling history, Southern professional wrestling history, and so much more. Without any further ado, the man of the hour, the host of the Studcast, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you?
I'm doing great, Brian. Just happy to be here, my man. And, you're right, I got old lightning saddled up, and we got another good ride in store today. We're covering a lot of ground on a lot of these episodes, burying ourselves a little deeper in Southeastern, and This one's a big one. It's a second Coliseum show, and we've been talking about this one for a while, but today we're going to really take a little deeper dive into it today.
We've been building it up. We've been showing all of the angles building up to it. We've been talking about all the booking philosophies that you've had building up to this show. This is going to be a really interesting moment for Southeastern Wrestling. The first Coliseum show, you had the NWA World Champion. You had the World's Women's Champion. You had a real stacked lineup. This show is a lot more of a local flavor. Even though you have people coming in like Jerry Jarrett and people from the other side of the state, these are your guys. You've now been there a little while. You've established your territory a little bit, and you've established who works for you. So this is a whole new ball game. But before we get there, I do want to make mention of one thing, Ron. As this show comes out, already released, the latest Super Studcast number 17, with Jimmy Golden. And of course, Jimmy plays a big part in a lot of these episodes that we are currently going through, where he has joined Southeastern Wrestling, he has rejoined his family, and he is there, and he's about to take off and become one of the biggest stars in Southeastern Wrestling. But this Super Studcast is so much more than that. In the previous Super Studcast, we had Robert Fuller and Ron Fuller, the Fuller brothers. But this time, we have the Welch cousins. And this is so much fun. Check out part one now. It is incredible. It is Southern wrestling history, as well as fun stories and anecdotes with Jimmy Golden. You can get that right now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. This is a tremendous show, and you get to hear, like I said before, the two Welch cousins describe a life like no other in any sport or in any other walk of life. This is a fun episode, and I know we're going to talk a little bit more about it later in the show, but Ron, getting back to the main topic this week, where are we starting?
Well, today's Studcast is going to start with some territory history. We haven't done that in a while. Specifically, we're going to talk about the Tennessee Territory from the time of this Coliseum show, basically, until about 2 years later in 1977, when everything in the state of Tennessee and the territory of Tennessee is going to completely change. Most of today's Studcast will be my tribute to the second Coliseum show in Knoxville. And for the first time ever, it's going to be on a Sunday afternoon of March 23rd, 1975. We're going to discuss this show in great detail today as the wrestlers that came from all over the country to support my efforts to build Southeastern were there to help me to start the beginning of one of the greatest small territories in wrestling. We're going to also talk about the card and the results of every match, my thought about the successes of the day, and the disappointments, if any, for the day, and how I plan to follow this event with the next Coliseum show. I'm also contemplating a change in some of my own wrestlers. So it's a big decision. That's a very important one. That will be my first talent change since opening Southeastern Wrestling. And that's something every promotion and every wrestling company in the world had to do, was change their talent. And we're going to get into our first talent change about 5 months in. So I'm ready to roll. If you are, my man, I'm gonna give lightning the spurs here and see if we can't get him to climb up one of these smoky mountains here.
Well, you mentioned territorial wrestling history. It's been a little while since we've had some of that on the show. We've been covering everything as it was happening in chronological order. I think the last time may have been when you discussed a little bit of the background in Knoxville, but there's a lot going on. And of course, in a few years, Tennessee would completely change. So you said you wanted to start with some territorial history. Where are we starting?
Okay, so we're going to start today with what the Tennessee territory looked like in the spring of 1975. That's right in our time frame here. We are in the spring of 1975 when this match, the second Coliseum show, takes place. The owners of the Tennessee territory are still at this point my grandfather Roy and his partner Nick Gulas. Roy's about to retire because of his health. He's just about reached his limit as far as he can go. And everything is going to change in the Tennessee territory in the following 2 years after the founder, who is Roy, of this massive territory that he built, leaves. And at this point in 75, this is what the territory looked like. Just to give people an idea, the Gulf Coast area, which my father had established in 1954, was sold to his three cousins, Lee, Bobby, and Don, the Fields brothers, in 1958. That territory comprised the major cities along the Gulf Coast, like Pensacola, Florida, Mobile, Alabama, New Orleans, and most of southern Louisiana. They were still paying booking fee to Roy from Nashville, up in Nashville, the Fields brothers, but they basically owned that Gulf Coast territory. The east side of Tennessee, Knoxville in particular, was now owned by me, obviously, and I paid no booking fee because I'd already fought the battle with my granddad. And he says, yeah, go ahead. I'm going to let you buy without paying booking fee. So that was a big stroke for me. I think it really helped me to be successful. Jimmy Golden's father, Bill Golden, ran Montgomery in central Alabama and paid booking fees only. The existing area owned and operated entirely by the Tennessee Territory in 1975 was Birmingham and northern Alabama. These are the areas they owned exclusively now. As a part of the Tennessee Territory still. Birmingham and northern Alabama, Chattanooga, and everything west into Arkansas and Missouri, including Memphis and most of the state of Mississippi. In the north, everything in Kentucky was still owned by Roy and Nick, excluding the eastern side where my television reached and theirs didn't. And that's a pretty common thing in those days. If you had an overlap of TVs, a lot of times neither party ran them. But in this case, I'm going to eventually get to a big television station, and I'm going to be strong in eastern Kentucky, and Roy and Nick are not going to be. So it makes sense for me to be able to run those areas, and they're going to stay out of them. They have a few cities even in Indiana. The southern part of the state of West Virginia is no longer run as a part of that territory because it's a great distance from Nashville. So this area of the country will become a focal point for me, especially West Virginia, because it's within 200 miles of where I am in Knoxville. And because they're not running it, pretty soon I'm going to be in a position to move into West Virginia, especially the southern part of West Virginia.
At this period of time, explain how the Nashville territory itself is broken down. How, in terms of what wrestlers go to, let's say, Alabama or Nashville, and what wrestlers go to, let's say, Memphis or Louisville?
Well, what happens is you've got two owners here. You've got Roy, and then you've got Nick Gulas. Roy kind of runs the western side of the state. Jerry Jarrett is booking for him on the western side of the state, and they have their own crew because they run 6 to 7 nights a week. And Nick Gulas runs the eastern side of Tennessee, and he has his own crew. So it's a kind of an odd situation. You got the two owners. They're not operating as one entity. Each side of the state has its own crew, And they don't exchange those guys very often as well, you know, which if I was in that position and I owned that, I'd be doing a lot of that. I would be exchanging that talent back and forth. But they all have their guys that they like to do business with. And Jarrett's case, it's Tojo. It's Eddie Marlin. It's guys like that that he's very familiar with. In Nick's case, it's Bearcat Brown, and it's wrestlers that he has confidence in and that he's worked with a long time. Strange situation, but the entire territory, as long as it's been there, covering 10 states, has always been a strange little territory. Not a little territory, a monster territory. And I guess it really, in a way, needs to have two different crews. And it's probably, it worked very well for them. They got by really great with having it set up like that.
Ron, a couple of questions for you. One, you brought up Bill Golden. And of course, we talk about him actually on the Super Studcast with his son, Jimmy, obviously. What about Phil Golden? Because I know Phil ran opposition in Louisville and in various other towns to your grandfather and Nick and Jerry Jarrett. What can you tell me about Phil? Did you guys consider him a part of the family, or was he an outlaw to the family?
Well, he's part of the family, but he's part of Jimmy's side of the family. Bill Golden obviously is not related to the Welches, except through marriage. But Phil is his brother. So they both are promoters because Roy kind of operated the business as a family business. And if you were a son-in-law, that meant you got a chance to be in the wrestling business. You could either be a promoter, you could be a referee. Hell, he'd probably make a wrestler out of you if he had the skills. And then anybody related to your son-in-law that's family with him is welcome to be part of it as well. Roy utilized a lot of different people, and so did Nick, because their territory was so expansive, it was so large, you needed a large number of bodies in management to be able to control it and to be able to make it work. Within a couple of years, there's going to be a big problem between Dad and Jarrett and Nick over the west side of the state. They're going to split the territory within a couple of years. You know, it's a strange thing happening in Tennessee at the time, and I thought we might just talk a little bit about it today, kind of make the fans a little bit aware of what's going on in the Tennessee territory, which is a monster territory. And then the next couple of years, it's going to be just fraught with problems, one after another, and a lot of dislike, a lot of hatred, and a lot of infighting going on for control of wrestling in certain parts of that territory.
It's moments like that where you realize how lucky you were to get away from that booking relationship with the Nashville office.
Yes. Yes. There you go. I mean, whose talent would I be getting? You know, and what it was is I was getting Nick's talent when I first started there, and that's why I was getting so many substitutions. And Nick didn't care about whether I was successful or not, and probably didn't want me to be successful. Him and Roy could pick up Knoxville again probably if I'd have gone out of business, and that might have been what he wanted to do anyway. But I was getting talent from Nashville, but most of those guys were coming out of Nick's crew and not Roy's crew, which was always the western side of Tennessee.
And then eventually with the relationship with Jerry Jarrett, you would start getting the wrestlers from the western side of Tennessee.
That's it. Once I switched over and I no longer paid a booking fee, Nick refused to send me anybody. But Roy still had Jarrett booking for him. And I'm sure Roy was pulling the trigger there and saying, hey, you know, you need to help the kid. Let's get him off the ground. And thank goodness for that. And, you know, Jerry was very much on board with it, did a great job, sent me great talent, didn't have substitutions. It was a much better arrangement than it would have been if I had to continue to pay booking and work through Nick.
One last thing, Ron, before we move on. You mentioned before how by the time we got to 77, it becomes Jerry Jarrett with your father, Buddy Fuller, as his partner, going up against Nick. How did Buddy get into that position? And what I mean is, after your grandfather retires, and after the relationship between Nick and Jerry finally dissolves completely, and there's been so much said about that, and I know you weren't directly involved, so I'm not going to ask you to give details on it because I know you weren't there, but in terms of your father getting involved, how did that happen? Because obviously he's the son of the former partner of Nick Gulas, and he becomes partners with Jerry Jarrett, who in many ways was a usurper. Whether he was ripped off by Nick or not, He was obviously trying to steal that part of the territory.
Well, you know, a lot of people did not have strong feelings for Nick. They didn't like Nick. He was difficult, and I had problems with him, and I only wrestled for him one time that I can remember in which we had any type of interaction. But I didn't have much good feeling toward him after that experience, and I don't think my dad did. I believe that Roy and Nick were probably having problems as well, because that's how they territory morphed into this situation in which one of them's running one side and one of them's running the other. That normally means there's a problem. When you have two owners and one runs one part and one runs another, that normally means that there's not really any cooperation between the two. And I think Dad got in a situation to where Jerry was making the towns, doing a good job of booking, not being a problem, coming up with some good talent. And Dad just took a liking to him. They probably spent time together, in which Dad didn't spend much time with Nick, didn't have the opportunity to. And I think that steered it in that direction way early on, that Dad, when he pulled away, would go with Jarrett rather than go with Nick.
You said a lot of people didn't like Nick. Did your father like Nick?
I don't think he was particularly fond of Nick, and I don't think Nick was him. I always think back of the story Dad told me one time about the promoters in the South met in Charlotte with Jim Crockett Sr., and they set at a big table in which there was every promoter in the South, basically all the way from McGurk in the West, Leroy McGurk, to obviously Jim Crockett Sr. there. All sitting around the table. And Nick, in the middle of the conversation, pulls out a $1,000 bill. And he's bragging about it. You know, boy, y'all ever see one of these? He's a big bragger anyway. And, you know, you ever seen a $1,000 bill, man? So he says, let me just pass it around. Everybody can look at it. Well, you know, those guys all had money, right? It wasn't like they were broke.
Yeah.
And they couldn't have gone and got themselves a $1,000 bill. So everybody looked at it politely and passed it on. And when the $1,000 bill got to Dad, he took it and tore it in half. And Nick almost died. It was like he wasn't going to be able to ever get that money back, right? He was like, oh, yeah, what did you do, boy? You know, so I guess, you know, that was kind of like their relationship was developing, and it really never went to where it should have for any cooperation between Dad and Nick, for sure.
So that's obviously where the Tennessee territory would end up in a few years, but you began that by talking about where it was at this point in March of 1975. Let's go back now to where you were at this point in March of 75. You're getting ready for the second Coliseum show.
Yes, I am. And I've been preparing for this for weeks. And I think in order to talk about this, I'd like to go back to the beginning. And the real reason for the Coliseum show and the reason for the day it's being run on, Friday nights had always been the night for wrestling in Knoxville, even going back to the beginning of wrestling there in the early 1930s. And my grandfather set that town up like he did almost every big city in his territory. And his brother, Herb, and Jack and Lester, his three brothers, they were all stars in Knoxville from the 1930s all the way into the 1960s, as well as Roy, obviously. My grandfather made the decision for all the cities in his massive territory as to which night each one was going to operate on. His Tennessee territory spread across the southern United States, like I said a minute ago, from Kentucky south to the Gulf of Mexico, and from Georgia east to Arkansas and Missouri in the west. He controlled 10 states when it came to wrestling, and obviously is one of the largest territories that were ever built. He maintained control of many of these cities until his territory became so large that he was forced to sell the rights to some cities that were on the edges of his territory, meaning they were so far away from where he actually was, he couldn't be there to have complete control of them, so he decided to sell them. And when he would sell those cities, then he would add an additional agreement that the buyer had to sign that said that he agreed to get his talent from Roy, his wrestlers from Roy, and as long as he got his wrestlers from Roy, which is as long as he was there, Roy wasn't going to allow it to be any other way, he had to pay booking fee. And so By Roy doing it that way, he got some money for the town, and then he's going to get money for years by just sending wrestlers to the town and not having to worry about it. It's a hell of a deal, hell of an idea. And so Knoxville's one of those cities on the extreme edges of the territory, and he sold it to George Kazana, who later passed it on to his brother, John Kazana. And as everyone knows now, I bought it from John in October of 1974. The Kazanos brothers left Knoxville running on Friday nights, as Roy has set it up many years earlier. Nothing changed as far as what Roy wanted to do. And even when they bought these towns, they still usually kept them on the same night that Roy had originally run them on. So Knoxville being a weekly Friday night town became a problem for me on this particular Friday night of March 21st in 1975, when the park building, which was the Jacobs building that I was operating in, was not available. And that was very rare. Didn't happen very often. So it was not good for business to miss a weekly match for this type of thing. And I was forced to check with the Coliseum to see if that Friday was available there. I didn't really want to go back to the Coliseum again so soon after that January 24th, 1975 first Coliseum show, in which Jack Briscoe wrestled Nelson Royal for the world title. And that had been only 2 months earlier. I wasn't ready to go back to the Coliseum yet, but I didn't have a Friday to run in the building, and I needed to run. I wanted to run. So I went to talk to the building in the Coliseum, and Friday, obviously, naturally, wasn't available. But the Coliseum manager says, well, Ron, we do have Sunday, 2 days after the Friday you're looking at, and it's available. So long story short, and I think I've mentioned this some already, is I took it. I took that Sunday, and then I struggled with an idea I had to, if I'm going to run on Sunday, maybe I'd be better off to run because it's in the wintertime in the afternoon rather than run at the normal 8:30 p.m. starting time. 8:30 on a Sunday night is a pretty horrible time to have to run a wrestling program, especially when fans are accustomed to a weekend Friday. So after finally deciding to try the first ever Sunday afternoon ever in the history of Knoxville, I began then to work on the card. Speaking of the card, let's just jump right into that, Brian. This is the card for the second Coliseum show. I called in favors when I started putting this together from the Sheik, from my friend Bobo Brazil, from Jim Crockett Sr. in Mid-Atlantic out of North Carolina, from Jerry Jarrett, who is booking the west side of Tennessee. I needed talent. I'm back in the Coliseum. I'm on a Sunday, and I'm going to try a very chancy afternoon show. So I need support from my friends and people that will try to work with me. So I get guys from all of these people, and the rest of the card are my regular guys that's been working there for me. So as I read this card, I want to talk about the match results and even give some history of some of the participants to go along with those match results. First match, Jerry Jarrett versus Phil Hickerson. And this match involved two wrestlers from the West Tennessee area over there, from Roy's, basically, Roy's side of the territory. And let's touch on some of the history about both of these guys. Jerry Jarrett was born in 1942 and was trained by Tojo Yamamoto. He wasn't a big enough guy to be a huge wrestling star. But Jerry had a great mind for the business, and he's going to have great success in the sport of wrestling throughout his entire career. During the time frame of this Coliseum show, he booked the western side of the Tennessee territory for Roy and for Nick. They're both still partners at this point. So he's working basically for Roy and Nick. But he never sees Nick. Roy's the only one that comes to Memphis. Nick's always in Birmingham on Monday night. That's the other key town in that territory. So Nick's never in there. Roy's always there. And I think that had a lot to do with Jerry wanting to use me, and he wanted to use Rob. He would use Jimmy. And he was very good friends with my dad. So we're getting talent then from that part of the territory. And Jerry's going to get inducted into actually the NWA Hall of Fame for his accomplishments basically as a promoter. He was responsible for most of the talent in the first three matches of this card, this second Coliseum card on Sunday afternoon. And most of these guys live in Nashville and come out of Nashville. Jarrett's opponent was Phil Hickerson. I don't know if a lot of fans know much about Phil, but he was another future star, and he was trained by guess who? Herb Welch, who had trained Honky Tonk Man, Wayne Ferris. He trained David Schultz, trained Coco Beware. Now he's trained Phil Hickerson. He was also born in 1942, the same year as the guy he's wrestling in the match that night, Jerry Jarrett. And he's going to return many times during my run in Knoxville, Phil. He's going to work for me quite a bit. And later on, he and Dennis Condrey will win the Southeastern Tag Championship on two occasions, August 11th, 1978, and again on November 3rd, 1978. Phil Hickerson was voted into the Memphis Wrestling Hall of Fame in 1995. And years after he retired, he was a very popular DJ on a radio station in Jackson, Tennessee, and he may still be there. I'm not sure whether he's still alive or whether he is still in Jackson, Tennessee. But he was a great personality for Jackson, Tennessee. A big guy and a quality athlete in the ring. Pretty darn good. This match was a perfect example of the way to open a huge night of wrestling. These two had worked together many times, and the fans, and they had the fans in their pocket the entire match. It was just about as perfect a way to start a show as a promoter anywhere in the country would have liked. And Jerry Jarrett won this first match of the night.
Ron, most people think of Jerry Jarrett, obviously, as a promoter and a booker. But as you said before, he did get into wrestling. It was an interesting story because he was obviously involved in The Office. His mother was in The Office with Roy and Nick in Nashville. And that's how Jerry got in the door. He would ride the shows with Roy Welch. And eventually he decided, against his mother's wishes, from what I understand, that he wanted to be a wrestler. And he had Tojo train him. How was Jerry in the ring? How was Jerry? A lot of people think of him as just a promoter and a booker. But as an actual wrestler, how was Jerry?
Jerry was a pretty good worker, what he was really good at was selling, and it was because he wasn't big, and he would get a lot of heat, man, when he would work with guys, and a lot of times he was working with Tojo, because Tojo's a heel at this point, and Jerry's just becoming a babyface, and, it was easy to get heat on him, because he sold really good. And then, he worked a lot of tags matches where he would get the heat and then give the other babyface, the bigger guy, the hot tag. That's a winning combination right there, because then that other guy's going to come in. The fans are going to think he's going to do better than the guy that's been doing the selling. And he does do that. He makes the big comeback. It was a great deal. I had a career with my brother as a partner. And a lot of times, most of the time, I got the hot tag simply because I was the bigger of the two guys. And it's a lot better. It's a lot more fun to make the big comeback than it is to do the hard sell and take the bumps. I can tell you that.
You mentioned Tojo before. Tojo is here in Knoxville. He's in the second match.
Yes. Tojo's right on this card. He's real close with Jerry Jarrett. I'm sure he made the trip with Jerry Jarrett, as a matter of fact. And Tojo's going to wrestle another pretty darn good worker named Lorenzo Perini. And Tojo was one of the most popular wrestlers in Tennessee history. He began as a ruthless heel, despised by his sneaky attacks on his opponents. Gosh, I remember watching Tojo in the late 50s, 59 and 60, in the fifth and sixth grade of school, and just hating him, man. And so did everybody else. He had fabulous heat for many, many years. And after he turned babyface, he was over spectacularly for years. He never went back to being a heel, because he got over so good once they turned him babyface that they left him there. He had a lot of young partners, like we're talking about. Rob was one. Jerry Jarrett was one.
Tommy Rich.
Tommy Rich was one. He just, they fed in these young guys, and them boys went out there and sold like crazy and gave him those hot tags, and the people are ready for him to come in with his wooden shoes and start clanking heads and stuff and doing his gimmick. And wow, he was over. He was big money in Tennessee. Tojo was big money in Tennessee, and there's no doubt about it. I was lucky to have him on this card, and I really liked the fact he was on the card. And Lorenzo Perini, now he'd worked in Tennessee territory many times by this point, and he was, like I said, a good worker. So this second match was won by Tojo by disqualification. There was a lot less wrestling in it than the first match, but I was not concerned because this was early in the card, and there's a whole lot of darn good wrestlers to come in this show on that night.
Ron, a lot of people see pictures of Tojo, and they see his height, and they see his look, and they go, come on, how could this guy have been a main eventer for so many years in the Tennessee territory? What are they missing? Because obviously he was a major attraction as both a heel and a babyface, like you said, one of the most popular wrestlers in Tennessee wrestling history. What are fans who see a picture and judge him based on that missing?
Well, you know, how they got him over was they put him over. He beat everybody. And I don't care what size you are, if you're constantly winning and winning and winning and winning against the biggest of the biggest and against the smallest of the smallest, you don't lose, you're going to get over. Unless you have no ability at all. Now, Tojo had enough ability, and especially as a heel, he had this little thing he used to do, and he'd get a guy down, he would rake his eyes, and then he would pound him down to the mat, and then when the guy started to get up, he would bend over in a creepy little style and sneak around behind him, and then nail him from behind when the guy was about ready to make the comeback. I mean, he just had a good style about him, and he was put over long enough and strong enough that people believed, and they bought it, and they kept buying it. The third match, let's talk about the third match, Danny Hodge versus Jimmy Golden. Now, this is the first of three events on this card, and I'm going to call it a historic card at this point, that's going to involve an Olympian. And I'm not sure... Brian, if anybody know, you probably would, but this may be one of the fewest, if not the only professional card in history that ever had three Olympians on it.
You know, off the top of my head, I actually can't tell you. That's one of those things I would have to look into. Obviously, there have been various Olympians getting involved in professional wrestling, but how many times were they congregated on the same show? That's a good question.
Yeah, you know, so I've got on this show on March 23rd, 1975, three Olympians on that card. So before we get to the match, I'd like to give people a little history about, let's just talk about Danny Hodge, okay? Daniel Allen Hodge is Danny's real name. He was born in 1932 in Perry, Oklahoma. Danny is widely considered one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, amateur or professional. I don't care what type of wrestler you want to talk about. There's probably never or hardly, maybe never been anybody tougher than Danny Hodge. And in his, just as facts that prove it, in his illustrious career at the University of Oklahoma, he went undefeated. He was 46-0 in his college career. And during his entire college career, he was never taken down a single time by another wrestler. That, to me, is just unbelievable that he's that good that he never gets taken off his feet, much less loses a match. He's so good that he's one of the only two college wrestlers in history ever to win three national championships in a row. There again tells you, my gosh, he's in a class where, you know, people, the wrestlers just don't get any better than that. He wrestled in two Olympics, and he won a silver medal in the 1956 Olympics in Melbourne, Australia. And he would have won the gold, but he was disqualified when he hurt his opponent. His opponent was a Bulgarian named Nikola Stanchev. And Danny hurt him by just grabbing him by the ankle. And he had that fantastic grip, and he's all keyed up, and he's really trying to win the match, and he squeezes down so hard on his ankle that the Russian screams and he injures him. So what they do is they basically give the match to, because it's an amateur match, so you're not supposed to hurt people. So he doesn't win the match. He actually loses the match. So, You know, and I've talked before about him squeezing this apple. And, you know, so fans, I want fans out there to know that I put a photo up on my gallery for every single Studcast that's done, and a photo on the on my website for those for Studcast to show who we're talking about. And I've already picked my photo for this number 95 episode. And if fans want to go to my website at tnstud.com, they'll find a picture of Danny Hodge squeezing an apple with one hand in front of the Oklahoma House of Representatives in 2013. He's at the age of 81. That's right, Brian, 81. Can you believe that? At 81 years old. And when they look at this picture, if people go and look at this picture, I want you to focus on the juice running out of this apple while he's crushing it. It's absolutely unbelievable, man. And I'd seen him do this many times, but I'd never seen a photograph of it. And I happened to find this photograph just recently. And I'm putting it on my website. You can find it under the gallery. You can just look, or you can find it on under a regular Studcast. If you look at the either one, you'll see this photo of Danny Hodge squeezing this apple. And you can see the people standing behind him. They're all in government. They're all in the House of Representatives in the state of Oklahoma. They're all dressed in suits. I believe Danny's dressed in a suit. As a matter of fact, he's crushing this apple and he's dressed in a suit. It's really an amazing, amazing shot. So, what a strong, just an unbelievable strength he had in his hands. I read an article one time that said he had twice the tendons in his hands of a normal human being. And that's where he got all that strength from. And when you're a wrestler, your grip is just tremendously important. And, nobody had a better grip than Danny Hodge. And he was so fantastic that as an amateur wrestler, that he got the biggest honor that I've ever heard for any professional wrestler. He has a trophy presented to the amateur wrestler each year. The best amateur wrestler in America receives the Danny Hodge Award. It's equivalent to the Heisman Trophy for a football player. It is the biggest award in amateur wrestling, and it's named after the greatest in amateur wrestling, and Danny Hodge. In my opinion, Danny Hodge was the most legitimate professional wrestler that ever lived. And nobody had more legitimacy than Danny Hodge when it came to saying he was a wrestler. It was an honor for me to have him on this card. And it's an honor for any wrestling promoter anywhere in the world to have Danny Hodge on their card. And promoter would just beg for that opportunity to be able to book a guy like Danny. And he's wrestled on so many of my shows in this first 5 months that I've been in business. So, and what happens in the match that night, we'll talk about the match. It was fantastic. I went out and watched it because it's going to be a 30-minute draw. And Jimmy's he's just beside himself with God, I mean, anticipation of what he's going to do against Danny Hodge. I mean, you know, so, he's aware of the legend, and Danny's a legend even at 75 and at an early age. He was a legend when he started. So Danny gave Jimmy a great portion of this match, and it really helped to get Jimmy over. During the match, they did a very difficult bridge move where both wrestlers are on their backs, one on top of the other. Their feet are pointing in opposite direction. Hodge is on the bottom, and Jimmy's laying on his back on top of Hodge. And Hodge on the bottom, with his back to the mat, pushes, has the strength and the tendon strength in his legs and his body to force both of their bodies up off of the mat into a bridge position. And Jimmy was able to switch his arms underneath and backslide Danny down to the mat and almost pinned him. It was fabulous to watch. And the crowd went crazy because they had probably, I am absolutely sure, in the city of Knoxville, they had never seen that move before. And everyone watching it had to realize when they watched them do it, how difficult that was to do. And I'd only done the move myself a few times in my entire career because it took a lot of power and it took so much out of you to do a move like that to get it done. So Jimmy and I talked about this move. We're going to, in the new Super Studcast that you've already mentioned, Brian, that part one is done. And we get into the discussion about this move that happened in that match. So by the end of this match, this card is off to a fantastic start. This match is a 30-minute Broadway toward the end. Jimmy is about to beat him for the last 10 minutes of it. Must be 15 false finishes in which Danny kicks out on two. Just a phenomenal match and a phenomenal start for Jimmy in the territory.
We will return in a moment with the rest of this spectacular Sunday afternoon card in 1975 in Knoxville. But first, a word about the aforementioned Super Studcast number 17, part one, with Jimmy Golden.
Super Studcast number 17 is special for Ron Fuller because it involves a family member. And in his opinion, one of the most underrated stars in the history of professional wrestling. At tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast, part one is now available worldwide. And fans have been asking for him since the Super Studcast began. This wrestler has literally been all over the world. And he's been a fan favorite in at least 14 countries. He's been in the ring as a performer for 50 years. This Super Studcast covers the career of one of the all-time greats, from his start as a handsome young man on the Gulf Coast to his reign of terror as WCW's ornery Bunkhouse Buck. He's wrestled for just about every major company in history, and his legend now follows him into his own Super Studcast. We are very proud and honored to welcome the Stud's first cousin, Jimmy Golden, for 3 hours of family fun and true wrestling history. Listen now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99.
There you hear it, the latest installment of the Super Studcast. Super Studcast number 17, part one with Jimmy Golden. This is a spectacular 90 minutes diving into Welch family history, wrestling history. Get to hear so many really fun stories, stories that have been not told too often because not too many shoot interviewers are asking about Bill Golden. You got to check out this show. It's at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 gets you in the door. It's the best deal in wrestling. And like Ron said, the match we talked about before the break, Jimmy Golden versus Danny Hodge, we go into detail about that on the Super Studcast. So if you want to hear more about that, specifically from Jimmy, how intimidating is it to have to do a bridge with Danny Hodge? Find out from Jimmy on the Super Studcast, but we'll have more about that at the end of the program. Ron, let's get back to this show. March 23rd, 1975, a Sunday afternoon in Knoxville. The fourth match is up next.
Okay, Professor Dale Lewis is going to wrestle Rocket Monroe. This is the second match in a row with a wrestling Olympian in it. Pretty amazing. Back-to-back matches with two Olympians. Dale Lewis is really over at this point. He's never been beaten yet by any professional or a challenger from the crowd since his arrival in Knoxville. Rocket Monroe can't hang with him, obviously. Dale's going to put him away pretty easily. Before the match, Dale and I talk in the dressing room about the number of challengers from the audience that he might want to take after this match. And because this is a Coliseum show and not a normal smaller crowd at Chilhowee Park, Dale wants to do it maximum. He wants to have these people be able to see these shoots. And so we talk about it, and we both agree that five would be the maximum. So they started lining up at the end of that match like they always do with his matches, and they bring them out there, those guys that have wanted to try this, and they line them up. And he finishes off Monroe, and he starts on the five guys that are standing out there that have been selected. And we both talked about it. We expected there were going to be a lot of challengers, and because it's in the Coliseum and you've got more bodies and you've got people that don't normally come, there's a lot more challengers that night. And they all want that shot at $1,000 bill. But, nobody's going to get it, obviously. And because this is a college town, this is the home of the University of Tennessee, Knoxville is. We had two challengers that night that I thought looked like football players, and I was expecting something like that. But they didn't do any better against Lewis than the guys that look like hell. I mean, you know, Dale was just so fantastic a wrestler. And while I'm standing back in the back of the building watching these shoots, guess who's standing next to me? Danny Hodge. You know, and Hodge's watching this, and I hear him mumbling a couple of times, grumbling maybe, not mumbling, but kind of grumbling under his breath a couple of times when he's watching what Dale is doing. But he never says anything to me about it or what he's thinking. You know, and as fate would have it, I'm going to find out the very next Friday night in Chilhowee Park exactly what what the grumbling and the mumbling from Danny Hodge is all about. Disaster is going to come to my door the following Friday. Fifth match of the night. I broke up the string of single matches with the Tennessee Tag Championship match between champions Dutch Mantell and John Foley against Nelson Royal and Les Thatcher. This match was great from beginning to end. They had the building on his feet for much of the whole contest. I was about to make some dramatic changes in the talent after this show, and some of the guys were leaving that are going to be leaving are in this match. Nelson and Les won the Tennessee tag titles that night, got a tremendous standing ovation from the crowd. It was another great match, and I was beginning to feel very good about the results of this card, about the fifth match in. Sixth match, this one was compliments of Jim Crockett. And the Crocketts out of North Carolina. They sent me two young stars. I asked if they could send me a match. They sent me two young stars, one of which is going to become one of the best of all time, Ric Flair, and the other is the third Olympian on this card, and his name is Ken Patera. Now, he's not a competitor in wrestling in the Olympics. He's a weightlifter in the Olympics. And he's the third guy on this card that was born in 1942, along with Jerry Jarrett and Phil Hickerson. That's pretty a big coincidence, too. I mean, and he's a big boy, Patera. He's 6'1". He weighs about 260 pounds, and he competed in the 1972 Munich Olympics just 3 years earlier, before this match. 3 years earlier, he's in Munich wrestling on the, lifting weights on the Olympic team. So he started wrestling professionally in 1973 after those Olympics. He came from a very athletic family and had two brothers that played in the NFL. One of them also coached for Seattle. So this match pits two stars out of the NWA Mid-Atlantic territory, and I could tell right away that they had worked together quite a bit. Neither of them were top stars at that time, but Flair is sure going to make his mark in the Carolinas. I let them handle their own finish. I spent some time with Flair in the dressing room since I hadn't seen him, and we hadn't seen each other since 1973 in St. Louis. He couldn't believe I was an owner in the business and congratulated me for it. And I would not see Rick after this match again for many years as he went on to become, obviously, the world champion. And I made a name for myself as the owner of the best small territory in the world. So their match was filled with wrestling in the early part, especially, and full of fighting at the end. It ended up in a double count out of both of them fighting on the floor. It was another great match, and I felt like it was another feather in my promoter hat from watching that one. The seventh match, this match was compliments of the Sheik and his Detroit company. The Mid-America heavyweight title match that night, seventh match, was Bobo Brazil versus the champion Crazy Luke Graham. And let's talk just briefly about the challenger, Bobo Brazil. Bobo's real name was Houston Harris. He was born in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1924 and died in 1998. He was 6'6 and 270 pounds. Bobo was a big man. He was considered one of the first successful African-American wrestlers and highly credited with breaking down the barriers of racial segregation in pro wrestling. He started wrestling in 1951 and wrestled from the 1950s all the way through the 80s. I wanted him on this card because we'd become friends in St. Louis, for one thing, but also because there were so few blacks attending wrestling in Knoxville compared to other markets in Tennessee. I wanted to expand my viewership on television, and I also wanted to expand my paying audience as well. And I knew Bobo would attract a new audience, especially since we're in a major venue. So we're in a Coliseum. We're going to get people that's never been before because they don't want to go to the small building in a cramped little environment. They want to be in a big old structure that's, you know, that's got and big matches like the ones on this card this night. So, I was right about bringing him in. I thought he would draw black fans, and he certainly did, man. The attendance, I could see the numbers were significantly higher on that Coliseum card with Bobo on it. And as the owner of a new wrestling company, I felt I needed every fan I could get, no matter what their race was. And Bobo and Luke lit that building up. There was limited wrestling action, but lots of action of all other kinds. And Bobo sure left his mark on fans in Knoxville. The main event, Texas Deathmatch. No time limit, no disqualification, falls count anywhere in the building, a 30-second rest period after every fall, a 10 count to get to your feet after each fall or lose the match. There had to be a winner, and the winner takes all, which means the winner's going to take the Southern Heavyweight Championship, and it's me against the hometown favorite, Ron Wright. The talk about this one starts earlier in the day when my wife, and who's been my secretary and is going to go that night and be my secretary for this match, she asked me earlier in the day, what time do I think we'll get home? Because I got two young sons and we got a babysitter, and she wants to know what time to tell the babysitter to expect us to be home. And so I tell her, we're going to be home a lot later than usual. And she asked me why, and I say, because we're going to the hospital after the match. And she goes, why? You know, like, what are you talking about? You know, and I tell her, well, you know, Ron Wright's, he's going to get tonight's his night. You know, I've hit him with his chisel about 5 different times. And tonight he's going to hit me with his chisel for the first time. And I fully expect that we're going to be going to the hospital for some stitches before I can go home. So that brief conversation kind of sets the tone for what's going to happen that night. After the Al Velasco near riot the week before, there was going to be absolutely no wrestling in this one. Ron Wright is going to get to have the type of match he really loves, that blood and guts thing, and this is his night. So she goes down to the ring with me, and she stands at the side of the ring in the corner in which I'm introduced out of. And Wright and I are fighting all over the building. The police follow us everywhere we go in the building. And so does a large part of the crowd. I mean, and we go everywhere. We fought behind the general admission. There were behind the ringsiders on the floor in areas in which you could see us. And in certain parts of the building, you probably couldn't see us. Sometimes that creates more havoc than anything when they can't see you. So this match was absolutely wild. Probably go a total of 20 falls and maybe 45 minutes long in the Texas Death Match. He goes for his chisel about 20 minutes in. And as usual, I clip him and I take his chisel away from him and I hit him. He's bleeding and I put the chisel back in my tights. And around the 30-minute mark, I get the chisel out to hit him again. This time, for the first time ever, he stops me and he takes his chisel away. So I got to run from him, obviously, you know, and I don't want to get hit by it. And the fans are certainly wanting. I don't want to give it to them too easily. So I run around the ring until he corners me in the corner where my wife is. And so he hits me with a shot in the gut, and I go down on one knee, and I intentionally turn my back to my wife. So when Wright grabs me in a side headlock, and he finally lets me have it with the chisel, I got my back to her. And he's waited 5 months for this shot, by golly, and I knew it was coming, and I knew what to expect, and it was everything I expected it was. He had no mercy, and almost instantly, I'm a solid mass of blood all the way down to my tights. And as soon as I spin around intentionally to face my wife, because I want to see the horror in her eyes when she gets her first look at the results of the chisel, right? And she instantly becomes sick, and she bends over in front of the whole crowd and vomits on the floor at ringside.
Get out of here.
And I mean, right then I said, God, I could, there was no way I could have planned anything better than that. You know, I was like, wow, look at you. There was something else. So Wright and I spent another 10 to 15 minutes bleeding all over the Coliseum, pinning each other everywhere, waiting for the 30-second time, and then waiting for the count, and both getting to our feet. And so finally, I end up giving him a pile driver on the concrete. That's what it takes to finally win it. And he actually got hurt in this match, and he's not going to wrestle anymore for a month until April 27th after the match. And this Texas death match, and God knows I have no idea how many I had in my life, this one is, by memory, one of the best, maybe the best Texas death match I ever had. And I never saw as much blood as what we had in that match, because I'd hit him with a chisel and he'd hit me with a chisel. And we were all bleeding. And I was right about the hospital trip. I ended up there. And I ended up with 16 beautiful stitches in my forehead, to come home with. It's a nice little thing to remember you by, correct? So,
well, Ron, let me ask you, now that you just went over the main event, how did this show, your second Coliseum show, do at the box office? And what was your assessment of this afternoon show? Because again, you're used to Friday evenings. Here you are Sunday afternoon.
Well, it was larger than the first Coliseum show just 2 months earlier, and by about 20%. So the Coliseum show, we had the first one about 2,500. This one, we had about 3,000. Obviously, I wanted more fans, but I had to be realistic. Only 5 months early, when I took over from John Kazana that first night, there were probably only maybe slightly more than 1,000 fans in the building at Chihuahua Park. So if I looked at it that way, and that's the way I wanted to look at this, I did not want to be disappointed with it. And when I really thought about it, your first night here in Chihuahua Park, you had 1,000 fans. Tonight you got 3,000. That's a 300% jump in your house in 5 months from the first night. That's a pretty good growth rate. So I had to be pretty impressed with that. And that's the way I preferred to look at it. What really got me enthused, though, was the fact that the Coliseum was only about half full. And at that time, I could only stand there and look up at those empty seats and imagine what a full Coliseum was going to look like. You know, and I wouldn't have never dreamed it would be a sight that I was going to get used to seeing regularly in the future. I couldn't imagine what the place would look like with the asses and all those seats. And wow, I'm going to see it so much in the future of that territory. It's one of the great, great thoughts that I have now. Just talking about it kind of gives me goosebumps.
Ron, to my second question, what about Sunday afternoon? How did it work out at being a Sunday afternoon show?
Well, as far as the Sunday afternoon success, I was pleased by choosing the afternoon rather than the night. As a starting time, I had luckily avoided a small snowstorm that came through that area on Sunday night. It hadn't really gotten there. It would have decimated me if I had have had that event at 8:30 on Sunday night, because it would have already been snowing, and fans in the South, the old deep South, they can't drive in it. They just think that's horrible. You can't go anywhere if there's any snow on the ground. So, you know, that murders you. So that Sunday afternoon was great. But it also set the tone for my decision later, when my territory was bigger and drawing better, to run on Sundays in the wintertime every time in the afternoon rather than Friday at night. That benefited me in two ways. One way, because there were more Sundays available at the Coliseum in winter than Fridays. Weekend dates were always the first dates to go in any big arena. And so it was something that would be unique with my territory to be able to run my main town on a Friday night most of the year, but when winter time comes, I'm going to run at 3:00 in the afternoon through the entire winter. And the second way it benefited me is even maybe more important. By running my main town on a Sunday, it gave me the opportunity to run an additional show every week in the winter on a Friday night. So since we would normally not be wrestling at all on a Sunday, this gave me an additional night every week to operate. So I could run 7 days a week during the winter if I wanted to. The boys love being able to pick up an additional payoff every week in the winter. So that Sunday afternoon idea in the wintertime would make my overall receipts better each week. It would pay my boys a lot better at the end of the week, and it probably had a great deal to do with my success at Southeastern Wrestling.
Ron, I know you didn't have a sellout here, but you were still pretty happy with the show. Were there any disappointments?
Well, you know, I'm kind of glad you asked me that, because actually there was one, you know, and it has to do with the results in the Knoxville newspaper after the Coliseum show. And to better understand this concern, we need to go back to Studcast number 93, where Big Jim Hess was making all those derogatory comments about Southeastern Wrestling, the promoters and the owners, and alluding to the fact that I might have some say in their decisions. You know, my biggest concern when I started to think about my own territory was whether I could own it and no one be aware of that fact. To me, it was absolutely necessary that I never be associated with the promotion or particularly with the ownership of Southeastern Wrestling. Big Jim had opened that door in Studcast 93, and it came back to haunt me after this second Coliseum show. I called in the results of the show after getting sewn up at the hospital, and the next morning when I found the results in the sports section, I almost fainted. And if you don't mind, Brian, you've been reading the results of shows for a while now that come from a gentleman named Tim Dills, who is really nice enough to send us every one of the ads in the newspaper and the results after all these shows all the way through Southeastern's history. Really appreciate that, Tim. And I was wondering, Brian, if you wouldn't mind, you probably got those results, reading those results, because something in those results is going to ruin my day.
Let me read the results, and then I'll get to the point in question, and I'm sure the listeners will know what it is. The results, March 23rd, 1975, Knoxville, Tennessee, at the Civic Coliseum. The opener, Jerry Jarrett beat Phil Hickerson. Tojo Yamamoto defeated Lorenzo Perenne via disqualification. Danny Hodge went to a draw with Jimmy Golden. Dale Lewis defeated Rocket Monroe. Les Thatcher and Nelson Royal defeated Dutch Mantel and John Foley to win the Tennessee tag titles. We saw Ken Patera go to a double countout with Ric Flair. Crazy Luke Ram defeated Bobo Brazil via disqualification. And in the main event, Ron Fuller defeated Ron Wright in a Texas death match. Wrestling returns to Friday night and to Chill Howie Park this week after the Sunday afternoon at the Civic Coliseum. Promoter Ron Fuller, who won the feature event Sunday, said around 3,000 fans saw the Coliseum show. Promoter Ron Fuller. Was Bob Roop writing the newspaper article?
Yeah, unbelievable. Huh? I mean, how in the world can that happen? You know, I mean, I don't think the guy even asked me when I gave him the results what my name was. You know, and then he goes and puts my name in the paper as owning the company. It was one of my, like I was just saying, it was something that I really just prayed wouldn't happen. And there it is right away. Bam. Just as plain as day in the paper. The owner is Ron Fuller. So I guess everyone can see why this particular results article was such a concern for me, since it plainly lists me as the owner. I think this is not an accident. You know, either how can this be a total accident? And maybe I thought right away, well, you know, maybe Jim Hess, you know, he's in that communication business and the media business. And maybe he's got a friend at the paper and he told him, hey, put Ron Fuller's name in there as the owner. You know, I'm thinking, how does that happen to me? That kind of was a big disappointment for me. I really liked everything else about that March 23rd card, that Sunday afternoon card. And I would never call in the results of my wrestling cards again. I gave that job to somebody else. And so I'm pretty much going to go another 4 years in Knoxville without being exposed as the owner of Southeastern until the Knoxville War begins in 1979. And we've talked about that, and we're going to talk about it on Studcast. And that is the subject matter of Super Studcast number 13. That's the all-time bestseller ever. But because that is a nasty thing for us to discuss, is that 1979 war.
Ron, I'll tell you what, we are getting close to the end of the show. We are actually running a little bit over time today. So I know you mentioned that you're going to talk a little bit about some of the talent moves you were making as the promoter. We're going to save that for the next episode. But one thing you did mention at the top that I do want to get before we end here this week, you're doing this show on the 23rd. You're already preparing for your next Coliseum show, correct?
That's correct. Yes. Just real quickly, what happened is I get a call from Sam Muchnick. He's president, obviously, of the National Wrestling Alliance, and he asked me if I'd like to have Jack Briscoe defend the world championship for me on a Sunday in April, just about a month later, barely a month away from this Coliseum show that we just talked about. And obviously, I would have preferred to wait, but you know, dates on the world champion are pretty darn hard to come by, man. And that's even for a well-established territory, much less I'm the newest member of the NWA. So I jumped on it because Jack Briscoe's he's a friend of mine. He's still the champion, and hopefully he's going to be the champion when this date rolls around. And I'd worked with him a couple of times already in 1975 for Jarrett over on the west side of the state in Memphis and in Louisville. So I knew Jack and I would have a great match and that we would really make me look good in my own town. So it turns out when we get to that date, April 27, 1975, that's the next Coliseum show. Jack does much more for me than just make me look good. I almost want to tell that one, but I'm going to hang on until that match actually comes. But this means that I've gotten the world heavyweight champion twice in my first 6 months as a member of the NWA. I don't think there's any way that could have ever happened if I had not had a great relationship with Sam Muchnick and with Jack Briscoe. And by the way, Brian, on this telephone call, Sam books me for dates in January and February of 1976 back in St. Louis.
Well, hold on now. I can't let you end on that. January and February of 76. So this is almost a year later that he booked you in St. Louis.
Yes. Yes. And I have no idea what that was all about at that time and booking me that far out, whether he knew that now that since I own my own business, I may be harder to get and I won't be available, or he just really wanted me. So we're going to find out down the road here, but it looks like I'm going to be going back to St. Louis.
Well, Ron, as we wrap things up here this week on the Studcast, we want to remind everyone they can become friends with you on Facebook. The page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can also follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter, at Ron Fuller Welch. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Great Brian Last. And you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts, classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. Of course, Super Studcast number 17 with Jimmy Golden is out now. You've heard us talk about it earlier in the show. This is a spectacular 90 minutes that you have to hear. It is available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 gets you in the door for this amazing bonus content. Jimmy Golden has been one of our most requested guests since we started doing the Super Studcast, and it is finally here, and it lives up to expectations. Check that out right now. Part two will be up in a few weeks, so you better make sure you listen to part one right now. tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, we're going to back up a little bit, and we're going to cover some of these talent changes that I'm about to make that we weren't able to get to today. And we're also going to put on my owner's hat again next week. I'm going to have problems like owners have. I'm going to start the process of courting a new television station to do my show. I'm going to witness the Danny Hodge and Dale Lewis disaster. I have no other way of talking about it. And I'm going to continue the war with my renegade commentator again. The war goes on there, and looking forward to it.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.